You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, I'm alive. You're alive. I think we can agree on that. But how do we know? And how important is it that we know that we're alive? The question of what it means to be alive, that answer can have a lot of legal, ethical, and other implications. Our next guest explored that question in some of the gray areas with a tour of the cutting edge of biology, from viruses in the wild to lab-grown neurons. He even evolved his own bacteria along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how we define life and some of the fuzzy areas around the fringe? What does it mean to you to say that something is alive? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Carl Zimmer is a science journalist and author of the New York Times column Matter. He's been a contributor to The Atlantic, National Geographic, Time, and Scientific American. Carl's written more than a dozen books about science, and his latest is called Life's Edge: The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. Carl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think we have this sort of ballpark notion, all of us, Carl, of what life is. But when you start to look on the fuzzy gray areas, as you spent a lot of time doing in this book, it turns out we don't have such a cut and dried definition. Why is it so difficult to say this is life and this is not?
Well, I think part of the problem is that we think it should be easy. You just said that you're alive. You don't have scientific proof of it, but you have this feeling that you are, and you're pretty much trusting that I'm alive as well. I'm not some zombie talking to you. So we have these sort of almost biological intuitions of life. But then when we get to know these things that we call life at the molecular level, they get actually almost more puzzling the closer we look at them. And any definition that scientists come up with, it's pretty easy to find exceptions that defy their rule or paradoxes. And so scientists keep coming up with new definitions. There are literally hundreds of definitions that and more added each year. A couple scientists I quote in the book, Life's Edge, say that there are as many definitions of life as there are scientists trying to define it.
And one answer to that question is to stop trying. You quote somebody, a medical researcher and ethicist, who says, you know, we're wasting our time trying to define life. Doesn't sound like that has a big reception in the biological community, though.
It certainly hasn't stopped people from trying to define life. I mean, those definitions keep on coming, but there are people, including some philosophers, who argue that we're really just barking up the wrong tree. Think about it, if it was 1500 and you went up to an alchemist and said, what's the definition of water? Well, if you look at alchemy books and writings at the time, you could guess that they would say, well, water is a substance that is transparent and is liquid and is tasteless. You know, they would give you a series of descriptions. And then you might say, like, okay, if the water gets cold and there's this stuff called ice, is that water? They say, like, well, no, because it's not liquid. It's different. So really what you would want to do is you'd want to wait 300 years until you had chemists that you could talk to. And they'd say, well, let me tell you about atoms and molecules and elements. And then we can actually talk about water in a meaningful way. So, you know, we're kind of in the age of alchemy when it comes to life.
Well, let's look at some of these interesting gray areas that you started to look at. And one, and I found this fascinating, you went and visited labs where, correct me if I have this wrong, because it seems pretty weird, they're taking what skin cells from humans, converting them to neurons, and then sort of growing clusters of human-like neurons. What's happening there? And is that life?
Well, these things are called brain organoids. You described the process quite well, that you can, you know, we can take a skin cell from you and scientists can put it in a dish, hit it with some chemicals. It will be transformed into a kind of a neuron that you would find in the head of a human embryo. And that will divide and multiply into hundreds of thousands, millions of neurons, which are all clustered together It looks like a little pea, and they form a network like your brain. It forms little layers, like in the layers in your brain of your cortex, and they have electrical activity. They do things that look a lot like brain waves. So, you know, the scientists are actually like doing this in order to understand diseases like, you know, viral infections that affect the brains of embryos like Zika, or disorders like autism. And so so they have like basic medical reasons they want to do this, but it does raise these really profound questions like, what are these things? And would we call them alive? They really do raise that question, you know, when does life begin for us humans? I mean, some people say, oh, it begins when you have a fertilized egg, or it's when something starts to develop, or, you know, sometimes we think of the brain as being the key to human life. So here we have these things that are becoming more and more human-like. There's metabolism going on inside of them. There's activity going on inside of them. They're very much alive. Are they human life? Like it really kind of breaks the brains of philosophers at this point.
We're talking to Carl Zimmer about his new book, Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Well, of course, viruses, a big topic this last year, Carl. And by most definitions, they're not alive, as I understand it. Why not?
It really depends on who you're talking to. One recent morning, I got an email from a scientist telling me viruses, of course, are not alive. And any expert will tell you that. And then that afternoon, I got an email from someone that afternoon saying viruses, of course, are alive. And any expert will tell you that. So there you go. That kind of gives you a sense of where we stand with life and with viruses. But the debate has been going on long before the discovery of SARS-CoV-2, the coronavirus that caused the COVID-19 pandemic. Basically, as soon as scientists started to figure out the molecular nature of viruses, there was kind of a big uh-oh, because they can replicate, which is a big thing that we think that life is able to do. They can evolve. You know, SARS-CoV-2 evolved to become a human virus, and it's evolving right now to get better at it as we see these variants spread around. So they're really good at evolving. So you've got those two things, but they don't eat. They don't grow. They have no metabolism. These viruses go into a cell and essentially take it over. And the cell makes new viruses. So for some people, that's it. That's where it stops. They cannot be considered alive. Other people say, well, wait a minute. You know, that cell itself has become a virus factory. So the virus and the cell merge into a living thing. This debate is nowhere near ending, but it's fascinating because it really does make you think carefully about, well, what are these things that we share the planet with, these viruses? I mean, there might be a trillion species of viruses, and we still can't settle on this fundamental question about them.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Daryl is with us in Couderay. Daryl, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Daryl?
Well, my comment is, the question of the hour is, what is life, right? Well, life is water, or none of us would be here, and no viruses would be here. It'd be like the moon.
Daryl, thanks a lot for the call. And Carl, I think you quote a scientist who says that like life is something like a process of managing water. I'm getting the quote wrong, but something to that effect.
Yeah, actually, yeah. So it was a Nobel Prize winner named Albert Szent-Györgyi, a Hungarian biochemist who discovered vitamin C. I write about him a lot in the book. He's this amazing character. He made some incredibly important discoveries about the fundamental natures of life in World War II while he was actually a spy trying to get Hungary and the Allies together against the Nazis. Unbelievable life. Yeah. An amazing person. And he once playfully, he once said that life is a play of water. In other words, that, you know, it's true that water is incredibly important to the chemical reactions that on which life as we know it depends. That's absolutely true. But that's as life as we know it. You know, is that a requirement of life? I mean, could there be some other solvent that that, you know, organic molecules or living molecules could exist in? It's possible. Some people have speculated on that. What about, you know, ethane or something like that on some moon around Saturn? It's a possibility. And another thing that I'll bring up is that, you know, even if we look at water as being really important to life, I write about some amazing animals called tardigrades.
Oh, yeah.
In the book. They're sometimes nicknamed water bears or moss piglets. They're these tiny little animals. You can see they're all over the place in the forests and the oceans. And if you have a microscope, you can see them. Now, every now and then they face the all sorts of kinds of different stresses, such as dehydration. And so the water starts to leave their cells. Now, you know, if you were dehydrated, you'd die. Actually, it wouldn't take very much water loss for you to keel over. But these tardigrades, they're fine, because what they do is they replace the water molecules with a special kind of sugar that functions like water, but doesn't evaporate. And then they also build proteins that are sort of like glass, and they basically encase all their DNA inside their cells and all the other proteins they need in these glassy proteins. And so they basically turn themselves into glass. There's no water left in them. They're frozen. There's no reactions that happen inside their bodies. So by, you know, by some definitions, they should be considered dead. They're not alive. But scientists say they refer to this as a third state. And they can come out of it if you just give them some water. In fact, they can survive this way for 30, 40 years and then pop right back into going about their business, crawling around as if nothing had happened. So, you know, we can make these blanket rules, but you better watch out that nature may have found something that completely turns it upside down.
Thanks for the call, Daryl. We're talking to science writer Carl Zimmer about his new book. It's called Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about the latest research into life, what it is, maybe how it came to be in the first place? We'll maybe check in on that in just a bit. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about some of the history of the search for a definition of life. Carl Zimmer is with us. His new book is called Life's Edge. You can join in if you have a question at 800-642-1234. Carl, I want to talk about the origins of life. Still big questions about what conditions needed to be there, maybe in the earth as it was a long time ago. And people are going, you found out, to the tops of volcanoes and to the bottoms of the ocean to try to figure this out. What do we know?
Well, there's a lot more that we now know than a few decades ago, when there were the classic experiments where scientists would just put a little spark into a broth and watch chemicals form there. The experiments that scientists have been doing have gotten much more elaborate and give us a sense of how the building blocks that might have been present on the early Earth could have come together into protocells with genetic building blocks, and then eventually evolve into life as we know it. Chances are that it probably started in a very simple form, like an oily bubble that had a little bit of RNA in it. You know, that may sound like a Moderna vaccine, and in a way, it kind of was. You basically had this molecule that could do a lot of sort of primitive tasks of storing genetic information and also carrying out chemical reactions. But where that came about is a subject of big debate. I focus on one scientist named David Deamer, who for decades has argued that the ponds that formed on new volcanic islands billions of years ago on the early Earth would have been the perfect place for this chemistry to get going. Now, there are other people who say, no, we got to look at the bottom of the ocean. We have to look at these chimneys where hot mineral-laced water is gushing out of the ocean floor and creating all sorts of crazy chemistry. And that's where life could have begun. They can't both be right. So it's going to be interesting to see how this debate plays out. But and it's going to have big implications for, well, how could have life begun on other planets or moons as well?
Let's go back to our callers now. Sid is with us in Madison. Sid, hello.
Hi. Thanks for being here. I was curious how you consider other like cultural perspectives on what life is and like what it means to be animate. And if that comes up in your research at all.
Sid, thanks for the call. And Carl, yeah, different cultures and different places through time might define life differently. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, absolutely. There are cultures in which life or maybe animacy is not unique to, say, people, animals, and plants, but to everything on the planet. There are lots of different ideas about when life begins. When does a human life begin? There are, you know, some tribes who feel that children actually come from a sort of a land of the dead. For the first few days after birth, they're still really belong to that other world. And so, so if there's an early death of a child, they look at that differently than maybe another culture would. They feel like, well, they're going back to the place where they really hadn't left yet. Certainly like when we talk about what science has to tell us about life, we have to make sure that we're clear on what we're talking about with life in the first place, which can really, you know, in some cases be very much something that comes out of our different cultures, as opposed to being some sort of quote unquote objective, nature of the world. And certainly like, you know, that comes down to like debates about, you know, when life ends. Are we going to define life as, you know, if a body is still, you know, able to metabolize fuel and to keep a steady body temperature, is that still life? Or do we look at the brain as being essential to human life? You know, brain death is death, and according to our laws, why do we make that choice? I explore that in the book. I mean, that is a choice that emerged in the 1950s and 60s with the advent of technology that suddenly like made it possible to keep people alive even when their brain was not functioning.
Thanks a lot for that call, Sid. We're talking to Carl Zimmer about his new book, Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. Well, Carl, I wanted to ask you, we've got this Perseverance rover on Mars. It's looking for signs of past life on the planet. Are we going to know, do you think, what life looks like? Could we conceivably encounter something that is alive in some sense? We just don't recognize it in that way?
Well, we should probably just have modest hopes in the sense that, like, let's hope that we find something kind of weird. In other words, something that when you look at it, you're like, I don't think that like regular geology could have formed that. Scientists will find molecules that are just kind of big and take a lot of steps to produce in if you tried to make them in a lab. That could be a sign of life. Or maybe organization, you know, in a fossil, maybe, you know, like maybe layers like you find in bacterial mats. That might be enough. We're not going to have a Martian just walk up to Perseverance and say, hi, I'm here. I'm glad you made it. It's going to be ambiguous. It could take a long time for us to really realize if life is actually staring us in the face.
What kind of research are you looking forward to now? What has you most excited when it comes to answering some of these questions about the frontiers of defining what life is?
I think there may be some scientists who may be able to make something like life pretty soon. And it may not really have anything to do with DNA and proteins. It may just be that like other chemicals can take on a sort of lifelike qualities, you know, and that'll be interesting. Like if they're kind of like life, but not quite in a way that might tell us more about life than if we were just to sort of, you know, create bacteria, which we already know about. We know about bacteria. So if you make bacteria, okay, fine. Whatever. But you know, like maybe there's something, you know, life might be a property of matter, the way superconductivity is. And it doesn't really depend on some particular set of elements, but it may just be something that emerges when certain conditions become right. But we need a theory to explain that, which we don't yet have. So, you know, I hope that we can live long enough to see that happen, but I can't say exactly when it will.
Carl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Carl Zimmer is a science journalist and author of the Matter column for the New York Times. We've been talking to him about his latest book. It's called Life's Edge: The Search for What It Means to Be Alive.